Hello and welcome to the Society for Acute Medicine's podcast. Here we discuss topics, cases, and anything new and upcoming in the world of acute medicine. This is our view and take. Remember to always do your own reading around the topics we discuss. Enjoy!
Hello and welcome back to the SAMS Acute Medical Podcast. We are here today to discuss stroke. This is part two. So if you haven't listened to part one of this podcast, I suggest that you go back and listen to that before proceeding with this one. I'm joined today with the magnificent Brendan Black, a stroke specialist. And I've also got Vicky Price here with us as well. Hello, Vicky.
I'm just upset that I'm not magnificent. Sorry. I'm just mediocre.
Yeah, we really thought it was going that way around the table.
Hello, everybody.
And hi, Brendan.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brendan. I'm ST7 in geriatric medicine trainee and stroke trainee.
Excellent. So previously on part one, we talked about ischemic stroke and touched on TIAs. In this podcast, we're now going to be predominantly talking about posterior stroke. So I'm going to start off with just a case, essentially. A 58-year-old gentleman presents to the ED department or the AMU with dizziness. I hate dizziness. It's so vague. How do you approach this?
This is sort of a classical scenario, isn't it? And we see them quite frequently in TIA. So I think the question we're sort of asking is this gentleman with dizziness, has he got a peripheral cause or a central cause? And I suppose for the purpose of this, we're specifically, when we talk about central, we're talking about stroke. I think with all things, and it's obviously not to, you know, state the obvious, but I think the really important thing to start with is history. And the first thing I always ask is, you say you're dizzy, what do you mean by that? Because what we as doctors call dizziness, patients have various other phrases, these giddy, lightheaded. And I think we're probably focusing a bit more on like vertigo actually with dizzy. So that rotational sensation. So I think clarifying that, because that can actually point you in a completely different direction. So, oh, I felt like I was going to pass out and my heart was racing in my chest. Well, that's probably a little bit different than what we're, you know, leads us a different way, perhaps a cardiac route. So I think clarifying very clearly with them what they mean and pin them down on it and say, you know, is the room spinning? The other thing is it there all the time? So is it there all the time or is it coming and going? So the things that you would be sort of classing in your head there is this an acute vestibular syndrome, i.e. that it has come on suddenly and is continuing on? Is it episodic? So comes and goes every so often, or is this spontaneous, you know, just one off? Okay. Because that can sort of lean you into sort of what it might be. So if it's an acute syndrome, they're dizzy while they're in front of you, then I suppose the two, broadly speaking, differentials you're thinking about is posterior circulation stroke or vestibular neuronitis, probably. There's obviously more to that, but I think that's most simple. The things I often think about as well then, or I often ask the patients is it associated with anything else? I think dizziness or vertigo sounding symptom isolated by itself in the absence of other signs or symptoms is unusual. It's not impossible, but it's unusual. So a recent case I'd had was a patient who presented with dizziness, did not have any significant cerebrovascular risk factors. The only thing that this patient added on extra was that they had a sensation of transient loss of sensation to their right upper limb. Turned out they subsequently then did have it was a right cerebellar infarct. So I think asking about, but there was that very subtle additional thing. So dizziness by itself is probably a bit unusual. Doesn't exclude it though. I mentioned cerebrovascular risk factors. I think that's really important to sort of paint the picture of, you know, the demographic of patient in front of you who's, you know, lifelong smoker, hypertensive, hyperlipidemia, type 2 diabetes. If they've got all of those things, you know, they've got a sudden onset vertigo sounding condition, they're probably at a slightly higher risk, aren't they? But of course, there's always the other side, you know, the younger patient with no cerebrovascular risk factors who was playing rugby and has dissected the vertebral artery and now they've got a posterior circulation stroke. So, but it is trying to paint that picture of what happened, you know, what actually happened, what were you doing when it came on? I think a slight pitfall is sometimes we are quite swayed by how the dizziness is brought on. So sometimes we think, oh, it only comes on when they move their head or when they change position. And immediately jump to BP, PP, probably is. But it can actually be stroke as well, which is confuses the thing even more. But classically, BPPV will be more when you move your head. But I think it's important just to keep in the back of your mind, even that simple thing from history wouldn't, you know, hasn't got 100% sensitivity. As well as sort of limb signs, I also add, look for other things, you know, was it an associated headache? Was it a typical migraineous type headache? Thinking about vestibular migraine. Other things, auditory problems, you know, is there a painful ear? If you look in the ear, does it look inflamed, infected? Okay, well then it's probably an ear problem, isn't it? Was there a recent viral illness? All of these sorts of things. Has it happened before? Or is this a one-off episode? So those are probably the key things I would look at in the history. And then with examining, goes without saying, a full neurological exam. But again, consider cardiac exam. You know, the dizziness actually could be presyncope, couldn't it? You know, have they got, you know, critical aortic stenosis, and actually they're just really dizzy because of that. ENT exam, if you can find an otoscope anywhere, which few and far between. And then the other thing that you will hear a lot for dizziness is the HINTS exam. And I think a lot of people hear about that, but it can be quite difficult sometimes to get right. And I think people's confidence varies quite a bit with it. So the HINTS exam is essentially a constellation of three tests. So you're looking at head impulse testing, a test for nystagmus, and a test of skew. So the first thing with the nystagmus is you're looking for horizontal nystagmus. So what you do is you get the patient to look on lateral gaze, but it's not at the extreme end. It's at about 45 to 60 degrees. So you're not bringing the red out to the end because actually that can be normal, normal physiological nystagmus. And you're looking for the fast phase of the nystagmus. And if it's unidirectional, that's reassuring. If it's bidirectional, so fast phase in both directions, or vertical or torsional, then that's more suggestive of central cause. The head impulse testing is when you get a patient to look directly at an object in front of them, keep their eyes fixated on that, keep their eyes open, and then ask them to let you to hold their head either side. And then very quickly, I'm actually demonstrating that myself and I realize you can't see me. So it's probably good to go and try and watch a video of this, but rather than me trying to describe, but you will move the head very quickly. If it is
just one side?
You check both sides.
But you do one side and then
one side and then the other.
Yeah.
And what you're obviously warning the patient, you're going to move their head very quickly. But as soon as you do that, they tense up. So it can be quite challenging to do. But so what in a patient with an acute vestibular syndrome, what you should actually see is a saccade. Okay, so you want to see a saccade. If you don't in somebody with an acute vestibular syndrome, then that is abnormal. So it's the one time in the assessment that normal is abnormal.
So just for some maybe more junior listeners, what would you describe as a saccade?
So a saccade, for me, I'm happy to be corrected, but in this case, it is when if I move the eye, we get the eye moving in one direction and then moving back to what it's fixating on. So moving, quite difficult to describe in words, but when it moves out of where it's meant to be and then moves back.
So like it, yeah. Like so a
correction of
yeah.
the gaze.
Correction, yeah.
So that's what we should be doing.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't do that, that's the abnormal thing.
Yeah. And I think the important thing is it's during an episode of dizziness. So if the patient has presented or had this yesterday, but it's gone now,
there's no point doing
the HINTS test.
Okay.
It's only during the acute episode, which can be quite challenging as well because they feel horrendous and they feel sick and then you're going to start moving the head. The final thing is the test of skew. So that's when you cover over one eye at a time, ask them to fixate ahead, keep their eyes open. And as you move the hand away, you should see that the eyes remain exactly where they are. If you find that, and that would be more in keeping with peripheral, if you find that when you've moved the hand away, the eye is deviated out or up or away and then comes back in, then that is skew, that's abnormal.
Okay.
So with HINTS, you have to have, it all has to be normal, all three. If one of them is abnormal, i.e. by that I mean one of them points towards a central cause, then you cannot exclude a central cause. But if you get it right and you do it exactly and you're confident in your findings, then the sensitivity approach is 100% actually for identifying a peripheral cause of vertigo or dizziness.
And we talked about this before we started recording the podcast, and the last one we recorded previously on previous stroke, we talked about show notes. So some of this is really hard, isn't it, without actually seeing it. So we'll put some links to some suggested YouTube videos to watch.
I think that's probably
and then there's also that table of those three that will be quite helpful just to see as well. The 100% was it sensitivity you said? Yeah, I suspect that wouldn't be when you audited Dr. Price.
I don't know.
But can you remember the first time you started doing it? Because I've only relatively recently started looking at HINTS exams in patients.
Yeah.
And I guess it's like anything. The first time I started listening to cardiac sounds, I hadn't got a clue. But then eventually it starts to... Is that the same? Because I'm beginning to think I can do it a bit better now after a year or 2 years of trying. Do you think that's happening?
Yeah, I think for me, I didn't really start doing it until sort of registrar years, really. And I think probably because of lack of confidence in doing it, I think. And I think even when I did start to do it, because actually, if you do it correctly, its sensitivity is higher than perhaps an MRI scan in the first 24 hours. But I still went on ahead and did an MRI scan.
Yeah, but it just...
But I think perhaps that was more for my own reassurance, really. But in theory, you know, you should be able to avoid doing brain imaging in such patients.
I guess doing it in all your patients, though, will really help, because obviously most of the people we see have got the peripheral course.
Yeah.
And actually, that when you get used to seeing that, you're then spotting a difference, if nothing else, aren't you?
Yeah.
So it's like listening to loads of normal heart sounds. Don't know what it is, but it's different. So it's just about doing it in everybody you see with dizziness, and then eventually you'll start to pick it up. It's difficult. I mean, I listened to two podcasts. Yes, there are other medical podcasts out there. Don't suggest you listen to any of them. But no, and one of them said, there's just no point doing HINTS because unless you're really experienced, it doesn't add anything, just get an MRI. And the other one raved at how good it was.
Yeah.
So basically listeners can choose.
I think that's
true. But unlike doing clinical exams.
Yeah.
It's, you know,
you don't get good at it unless you practice.
What's the point good of way being to become experienced is to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other thing about it as well. I think we talked about this earlier as well. I think it was actually originally developed by neuro-ophthalmologists.
Yeah.
And I don't think, as far as I'm aware, that it's been validated for sort of, you know, within sort of ED sort of environment, because we're probably not doing that frequently. But yeah, like you said, we just could practice.
But how often do you see somebody with dizziness? There's probably one per take, isn't there? So it's probably enough that we could start to feel. But like you say, you know, you don't replace every other investigative modality. But then I think this is a hard thing to diagnose.
Yeah.
So therefore, you need all your armoury. Okay, so talking about hard things to diagnose, am I right in thinking that posterior stroke is much more common than I thought? So about a fifth to a quarter.
Yeah.
But how many do we miss?
I know, it's quite a shock, isn't it? More than a third.
Yeah.
So it's probably around 35%. It's not a shock. And I, as I was saying earlier, I mean, I was even caught out with it last weekend on call. I think because it presents so non-specifically in some cases, mimics a lot of other conditions. Some of the symptoms that it presents, I mean, symptoms all, I from the last talk, I remembered stroke mimics all the S's. Well, this is all D's, diplopia, distato, kinesis, all of that. But I mean, those could be symptoms of many different things, couldn't they? And it's all about what the patient also perceives. I've got double vision, but actually what they're perceiving is blurred vision, you know, it's all a bit. And the symptoms are very subtle. And as well as that, they're not sometimes things that mislead people away from thinking about strokes, for example, bilateral signs. So if somebody presents with bilateral arm weakness or numbness, I think probably our first instinct might be to think spinal, wouldn't it? But actually that could be a brainstem event or cross signs, the other, you know, some ipsilateral facial weakness with contralateral, you know, limbs signs. And even more worrying, which is, I think it's very upsetting to know, but a lower motive. I know.
A lower You're meant motive. To make it all easy, so I walk away thinking, sorted.
So a lower motor neuron's facial nerve palsy can actually be a stroke.
What?
No. No, this is not fair.
It's quite rare, but it can be. So...
Oh no, the next few Bell's palsies are going to be phenomenal.
I know.
Well, actually, I think we need an MRI here.
But then, you know, with Bell's palsies, a slight side note, my thought on them is, I mean, people might disagree with me, but I think probably we do need to MRI them a little bit more, don't we? Because, like, unless it's a very clear viral...
There's a radiologist out there. Yeah. For Brendan to leave.
I don't know. I mean, I don't want to start any rows anywhere, but I just think, you think of the causes, you know, so even a Bell's palsy, I mean, could it be a space occipital lesion? Mm-hmm. Could it be sarcoidosis? Could it be bilateral Lyme disease? All them mm-hmm. sorts of things. But, and then now, of course, I've opened up this can of worms of saying it could also be a posterior circulation stroke. So...
So can you educate my neuroanatomy? So if it's a lower motor neuron,
spot here now.
where's the stroke?
Probably pontine.
Pontine.
Yeah.
Okay.
So sort of subthalamic, submedullary region where you'll start sort of getting ipsilateral.
Would you get other signs along with lower motor neuron?
Yeah. So that's what you should expect.
The cranial nerves.
And that would be, you know, so we said about the dizziness before. Dizziness associated with some other symptoms might make you think.
And your history.
And your history.
22-year-old female or something like that. Yeah.
Exactly. So all of this together, it's the same with the other possible strokes. You know, they've got, I think it'd be very unusual to just have a lower motor neuron facial nerve palsy in somebody who's had a recent viral illness, that with ear pain and that.
Very young person with nervous.
Yeah, I think you'd be very unlucky.
So it goes back to the initial history, doesn't it? And all your risk factors.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. Mm.
So sorry for that little.
And prognostication in these patients, how do they do compared to, say, a Taxotrectin, like we talked last time? Because I've got a feeling it's worse, but is that because we miss them?
Do you know what? It's not too bad. Okay. So I think something in the region of 20 to 25% mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably, I think it's about 20% actually. And that's it's more to do with, because if you think of the variation in posterior stroke, so you've got anything from, you know, a small cerebellar infarct, like I mentioned about a recent patient, mm-hmm. right up to locked-in syndrome with, you know, full pontine lesion or full brainstem event. And then subsequent after that, if there's any severe swelling or coning or whatever. So I think that it's there's two extremes with the posteriors, very minimal symptoms that resolve fairly quickly, right up to catastrophic. And I think that's probably where that high number comes from. Thankfully, those more catastrophic ones are fairly rare.
Yeah, and also we know something was going on as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If we think about it, it's MRI and that's going to solve all our problems, isn't it, Brendan? Because all the MRIs are going to tell us exactly what we're looking for.
It does feel more and more like within stroke, we just, the plan when you ask for advice is MRI.
Yeah.
Maybe I should say a bit about MRI. So just on that. So we probably do, again, very clinician dependent. Some will use MRI much more than others. But I think the important thing is that stroke is a clinical diagnosis. It's not a radiological one. So you'll see like infarcts on a scan, but equally you'll have infarcts but no clinical syndrome of stroke. So that's the important thing. So stroke or MRI should broadly be used in the context of stroke for if you're not sure.
Mm-hmm.
So if the diagnosis is in doubt. So say you think, you know, this could be a migraine or this could be a stroke, or, you know, I don't think this is a stroke, and you want that extra bit of evidence to show. That's one scenario where you're considering an alternative, or for example, demyelination. You think, could this be a demyelinating lesion or is it a stroke? The other reason to do an MRI scan is to identify the territory of the stroke, which might seem academic, but it's not. It's if you think about, we talked in the previous video about carotid stenosis. If you want to see exactly where the infarct is, to see actually if it's relevant to you. So, for example, you think this patient's clinically a lax stroke, and they have a symptomatic stenosis on IC stenosis on that side.
Yeah.
Or significant, I should say, IC stenosis on that side. But you do an MR and actually find out there's a it's a pontine infarct.
Yeah.
Well, then all of a sudden, that's actually quite important to the patient, because then they don't need to have carotid intervention.
Yeah.
Because it's asymptomatic now. So those are the scenarios, to know the territory and if the diagnosis is in doubt.
But I don't think I've seen many strips that don't get an MR these days.
No. Yeah. You'd get all other things, yeah. You know, like volume of infarcts, yeah. And people want to know. And there's actually a very helpful table, which I've unashamedly plagiarized from one of my consultants. I did tell him today. So I will reference him.
Okay, so we're not going to get Sam into trouble.
No. Okay. He's very kindly allowed me to share it. So we can put that in the pop-up. And it's basically what we use within our trust. Yeah. And it's a list of what we would say are indications and reasons you don't need an MR.
Okay.
And this has actually been looked at by one of our consultant radiologists as well, mm-hmm. And agreed. So I think it's quite helpful just to try and, because we do overwhelm the service of MRI sometimes, I think, and there's huge weights. Yeah. So
you implied earlier that there might be an optimal time to image. When is the optimal time?
That's a difficult one. So it depends what you're looking at. So arguably, if you did a sort of time of flight MRI scan, the stroke is just happening, we could get somebody to an MRI scanner straight away, you should start to see diffusion motor restriction fairly early. Again, if any radiologists listening, and that's wrong, I do apologize, but that's my understanding of it. But I've seen that the sensitivity of MRI in the first 24 hours for posterior circulation stroke is actually lower than it is at sort of 48 hours later. So whether or not it's taken more time, I don't know whether it's because it's a smaller volume of infarct, usually, don't know. For most situations, certainly in the UK, you're not going to get an MRI scan really in the first 24 hours, you know, so it's further on down the line usually.
Okay, so we've got our 58-year-old man.
Yep.
He's, we've taken a good history.
Mm-hmm.
It would fit. It was a fairly acute onset. He's hypertensive.
Mm-hmm.
He's got badly controlled diabetes, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got this fairly sudden onset of dizziness.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a bit ataxic as well.
Okay.
Throw that in as well. Mm-hmm. Let me give him some other symptoms.
Yeah.
Maybe he's had a bit of stuttering with his speech as well.
Mm. It's all coming out now.
It's all coming out because we ask.
We do.
When we don't ask, they don't tell us necessarily. I didn't think it was relevant. So we've done a HINTS exam.
Mm.
And within our limits of examination, we think that would point towards a central cause. We've done our full neurological exam as well, which would be consistent with some cerebellar signs, maybe. Is there anything else we should do before moving on to MR?
Yeah. So has he got an onset time?
Does it matter, Dr. Black?
Well, if this has happened within the last, we'll say, 9 hours, because we'd be dealing with posterior circulation. So
we talked about this with
on the previous,
I'm just wondering if it's any different.
It is. So
facts.
Posterior circulation strokes. I think the official guideline that we use locally currently still says 6 hours, but actually you can extend the window up to 9 hours if there's a favorable finding of salvage of brain tissue on the CT perfusion scanning that we talked about in the previous video. There have been situations where patients have gone for mechanical thrombectomy 48 hours after a posterior circulation stroke.
Wow.
So with posterior circulation, I would say for this man, we'll assume he's had a CT, an unenhanced CT head so far, and that's not shown a bleed. I'd probably go and get him a CT angiogram. Because just to see, is there a large vessel occlusion that might be amenable to thrombectomy? I'd probably also get a CT perfusion scan, depending on what his onset time was.
Okay.
Then if that was the case and we did see a clot, we could discuss it with our friendly interventional neuroradiologist.
Mm-hmm.
And if he goes for thrombectomy, then I don't think actually an MRI scan will be indicated. Because we have our diagnosis, we know what the problem is.
Okay.
The thing that you might do is, well, what you definitely will do is you'll repeat the CT brain within 24 hours just to check there hasn't been any hemorrhagic transformation or anything like that. And that will probably show an evolved infarct, perhaps, at that point anyway. So an MR is probably not going to add an awful lot more beyond that.
So I may be completely ignorant here, but in my basic brain, it's anterior circulation, CT head, you'll see, but once the time scale's right. Mm. Posterior circulation, you can't see them, you just need an MR. Is that?
Pretty much, unless it's a cerebellum occasionally.
Yeah.
And then with the eye of faith, I think, the other. But yeah, historically, just because of artifact and stuff, you understand you can't see an awful lot there. And for if you're trying to confirm the diagnosis or you want imaging, MRI is probably the best modality for it. Mm-hmm. Problem is you wait a long time for it.
You can still see stuff with a CT perfusion scan.
Yeah, so CT perfusion, you should be able to see.
Okay.
Because what I've seen happening is people are beginning to think about posterior strokes now. So they'll see them in the ED and maybe probably get a CT scan, which is normal. And then the next thing that happens is they're listed for an MR, which Peter alluded to can take days, but we've missed the boat then, haven't we, if there's a clear onset time. So that is the really critical thing, because if there is and you think this really could be, then you need to get your stroke services involved to get the CT perfusion scan or just get it yourself.
And that's the thing. So it all comes down to FAST, doesn't it? FAST was a government introduced campaign basically to help recognize stroke and get people to hospital faster and get intervention. But the thing is, FAST has a very low sensitivity and specificity for posterior circulation strokes, because if you think of the symptoms, they're largely anterior. So there was one I'd come across which is quite helpful, which is BFAST. So balance and eyes, any change to your balance, any change to your vision, and then FAST. The problem is, if you think of those symptoms, it's everybody who presents to the emergency department. So, isn't it? So you basically would end up just stroke triage and everyone. So I think it does.
Oh, you'd love that as a stroke.
Oh, it'd be brilliant. It'd be brilliant, wouldn't it?
I might actually do a trial of that one day when Brendan's uncle.
Just stroke, come down to A&E and stand here. So, I think my approach to a dizzy patient like this gentleman is, or any patient, I suppose I'm probably slightly biased from the specialty coming down from, but is I assume it's a stroke and then disprove it.
Okay.
So I will disprove it myself. If I can disprove it from the history and examination with reasonable confidence, then that's the end of it. You know, like our typical sort of vestibular neuritis case that we sort of briefly touched about before. If I'm not 100% sure, then I'll do more investigation, whether that's depending on the time criticalness of it, so whether it's an MR or whatever. Because the other side to it as well is it may not go for thrombectomy if the level of impairment from this presumed stroke is high, is too low, sorry. Yeah. So if it was just dizziness, say our man just had dizziness, but he was able to walk around okay, it probably isn't going to get much benefit from thrombectomy.
So quick, I'm slightly going off on topic, but while I think about it, I should ask, if it's a central cause, people tend to have disproportionate ataxia compared to sort of their symptoms when they're telling you, and then peripheral, they tend to have worse vertigo-ish symptoms. But then
That's what I've seen, and that's what I understand as well.
I mean,
well,
again, it's in the context of everything else you're picking up. But I
would say that's what I've observed as well. I mean, it might be someone completely who's done a study on it somewhere and said it's a load of rubbish, but I would say that is the case that I've seen. Whether I'd rely on it solely, I think, like you said, it'd be
in the context
with everything else. And I think that's what increases your sort of specificity, doesn't it? You've got sort of everything together.
Yeah.
But with, so we'd said about this man, so about the MR, we probably could go on to get an MR if we decided it wasn't going to be thrombectomy anyway. Well, probably don't need to get the CTA that urgently. And then we could just get an MR and we treat as stroke. So start on aspirin.
So this is a very radiology-based question, but obviously with a stroke, you ask for a particular stroke sequence MR. The problem is if you're torn between those two differentials, then the ENT guys ask for slightly different MRs, don't they? So what do you do in that instance? Do you get both?
Yeah, I do. So I think on our requesting system, it's MR auditory canals or external auditory meatus or something like that.
Yeah.
But that's what it is. So I will request an MR brain with diffusion weighted imaging, which is hard to request, you know, in the text, and external auditory canals.
So you get
because my question, I think it's completely irrelevant, because my question would be is, right, okay, the MR brain comes back as no evidence of infarct or diffusion restriction, I should say. I now think it's from the ear. Well, it's worth having a look at the ear to see, is there like a tumor there?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah,
you know, because if it's normal, that's probably reassuring then, isn't it? That it is viral, as we suspected. But yeah, just that one. Yeah.
So will the MRI always give us the answer?
No.
Brendan, you're not answering
it. You might say that.
So
what do you do? That must be a difficult situation.
Yeah. There's this concept of MRI negative stroke. And again, I know. And it's a bit of a contested topic. Some people think it's much rarer than it actually is. And if it is going to happen, it's going to be with the lacunar strokes and the posterior strokes. And if you think about the MR slices that they do, it's really small. It could fall in between those, couldn't it? So where I stand on it is, for the most part, if it looks like a stroke, it quacks like a stroke, it's a stroke.
Yeah.
Because stroke is a clinical diagnosis. The MR is just to support me. If it doesn't support me, then probably the best thing to do would be then to maybe put it past a colleague and say, please present this, what do you think? Can you look at this MR as well? We've got some very helpful radiologists as well. You know, sometimes you just need a second opinion on it.
Yeah.
And the neuro radiologists we can refer to as well. So I would probably pursue down that route if I felt it was going to significantly change management. But yeah, so to answer your question, will it always give you an answer? No, because if it did, then I'd be out of a job, wouldn't I? MR answers it all.
Yeah. And so in terms of, so we touched in podcast one about investigations and obviously don't go for crotch Dopplers and the posterior strokes. And management wise, is it pretty much the same as an anterior stroke? Is there anything different we need to do?
Yeah, there's a few things to consider. The etiology of it. So it's likely to be cardioembolic. Mm-hmm. So in those patients, I would have a lower threshold to echo, specifically looking for an LV thrombus.
Okay.
Or in the younger patients, you might think about PFOs, and which is a topic all on its own. So that would be the first. The other cause would be arterial dissection.
Yeah. Don't talk about hairdressers because I get paranoid.
Hyperextending
the neck. Every time I'm like, oh my goodness.
Or men shaving, you know, when they get the carotid. So in that case, you might actually do a CT angiogram for that reason, or an MR angiogram. Not obviously straight away, same day, same urgency as thrombectomy, but get that because that gives you a bit more information as to what caused it. The other thing to be mindful of is when you infarct in the posterior fossa. So with an infarct, you get swelling of the associated structures, and this goes on for a while. And then as the swelling comes down, symptoms seem to improve a bit. And then so obviously the cytotoxic edema, and then goes to vasogenic edema and then comes down. In your anterior brain, and particularly in an older brain, you have atrophy and you have more space to swell because the skull is a closed structure.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be prepared for the first 24, 48 or so hours where that tissue is going to swell. And in the posterior fossa, there really isn't much space.
Okay.
So what we say is for patients with large volume-ish posterior strokes, early referral to be considered to the neurosurgeons.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think it warrants a routine referral, you know, everybody for a stroke, because I think they become inundated. But, you know, perhaps even having a discussion with stroke and saying, this person's got quite a large cerebellar stroke. What do you think about referring? Because they may need decompressive surgery.
Because that's not something we touched on actually in the first podcast about.
And I suppose while I'm on that, but I should say is for the anterior circulation strokes. So is this devastating condition of malignant MCA syndrome. Mm. So this is thankfully, I don't see it all that often, but when you do see it, it's usually in younger patients. And that's because you've got more brain tissue, less room to swell. So what it is you have a large area of infarct in the typically middle cerebral artery territory. And as that cytotoxic edema is and the brain swelling, the brain can't really swell any direction other than down through the foramen and magnum. So you get tonsillar herniation and death. So the treatment is decompressive hemicraniectomy. The problem with it is that it's a, I mean, just unless something I've misinterpreted, something recent has been published, but it's more of a life-saving procedure rather than a functional improvement. So, you know, I think, so one of the things I think about is it an acceptable outcome for this patient to survive but be severely disabled? Is, you know, and I don't think you can answer that question really. You know, it's getting families' ideas and things like that. But
so from a practical point of view, for Peter and I, if we're on our AMU ward and we shouldn't have a large stroke on there, but there has been no other option because of bed pressures, and somebody comes in, it's a confirmed large stroke, that we're doing all the right things, we've got the lovely advice, what are we looking for at which point to stop thinking about that in terms of deterioration?
Yeah, so I would say in your sort of suspicion should be younger patient, probably, I don't think it's exact age, but say under 65, with a large sort of total anterior circulation stroke or middle cerebral artery infarct. You should, in your mind, just assume it's going to happen. Because, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. But the things you'd be watching for would be drops in GCS. You sometimes start to see hypertension evolving, quite resistant hypertension, kind of tachy or bradycardia, depending on levels. And then eventually what happens is you just get into the sort of signs and you would find a raised intracranial pressure. That's essentially it. There are criteria in our local neurosurgical centre for referral, and it doesn't take much. So I think they need, it's a bit more specific what they look for, but I think in sort of basic terms, it's if they drop one on their GCS, then you should discuss them and refer them.
With a CT or just straight discuss?
You can certainly re-CT, but I mean, if you've got a CT showing a big infarct with midline shift and everything, it's unlikely to have improved, has it? But I suppose it's useful in case they've now bled into it.
Yeah.
So of course you will. But you know, the other thing to be thinking about is start to think about getting anesthetics involved. And that's why I think what I tend to do is have a preemptive discussion with the neurosurgical team, say, this is somebody who may deteriorate. 90% of the time, they're quite happy for that phone call.
Yeah.
Maybe if they're really busy, they're like, we're not ready now, we refer. But often they do quite like that because they'll sort of anticipate that's going to happen, at least they're aware. Because then if anesthetics have to get involved, then they can do neuroprotective measures, and which I think are things like hyperventilation, aren't they? And head tilting. And so it's something that's devastating that happens. Thankfully, not too often. Hopefully we should see less of it now with more thrombectomy, but it does happen, and when it does, it tends to be younger patients as well. Interestingly, aging seems to be protective because you get this shrinking.
I'll be fine.
You see with some durals, don't you? Extra durals and things. There's like no symptoms. So
and there's enough space in my brain to accommodate this one. So in posterior strokes then, because it's all tighter,
that's why
it's a bit more concerning
because you said it's that sort of tight sort of skull area. There's nowhere else really to go.
Anything else in terms of management or investigations?
So we sort of mentioned, and I think the other principle still applies, sort of ET prophylaxis, the antiplatelet, secondary prevention.
So Peter's still on it. I don't know why we're teasing you about this. But I'm enjoying it.
I think that's probably...
Cardiac monitoring, you said for anterior stroke, 24 hours, but posterior stroke is more likely cardioembolic. Do you extend past 24 hours, or is 24 hours enough?
I think probably, I mean, it all depends on resource as well, doesn't it? So I think probably what we do in our new HASU, which is the hyperacute stroke unit, is we monitor patients while they're there. And that could be up to 72 hours, couldn't it?
Sure.
But I think sometimes, you know, patients are on different wards, whatever, they're not going to have that. And we have to then sort of select who actually needs the cardiac monitoring, you know, more emergently, really. But I think probably 24 hours is sufficient.
Okay.
I mean, if somebody's catastrophically very sick and you're really worried about mass effect and swelling, you'll probably continue it a bit longer. So I think that'd be more on, I think the phrase correlate clinically. We love that one.
Yeah, we anything else you want to share your wisdom on as we're coming to the end of our time?
No, I think that was...
Peter's got a key question.
I do, but it's not necessarily purely stroke-related. It's those patients who come in with dizziness or vertigo and you don't think it's stroke. You can't get them home because they can't walk. What do you do? What do you give them drugs? Do you get physio soon? How can you get them home?
Yeah, that's the challenge, isn't it? And I think that's going to be the barrier for any presentation, isn't it? If they can't walk.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, we don't often have a therapy service out of hours. So, and that's often what you're looking, isn't it? That physiotherapy, occupational therapy assessment.
Actually, that you've touched on something I always forget about in dizzy patients, that physio have a huge role there. Because they do epi manoeuvres for the, it is epi manoeuvres, I've got the right word, haven't I? But for the sort of vestibular.
Yeah,
do you like vestibular rehab? I don't really know how that encompasses how.
But that, so, and then, but that's, that can be hugely helpful. And it's something I often forget about as an option.
Yeah, absolutely. I've forgotten to mention that. So it's, but of course, it's just not access out of hours. So I think if they're not able to walk, they're not going home until they're seen in the morning.
Even I
would
try and
emulate
that.
Which is a shame. but I would say if they have very mild symptoms, they can walk, sit to stand and walk. And it's in the context of that dizziness alone. They can sit to stand and walk fine. They're not going home alone, you know, somebody about or whatever, I think, and you've got the appropriate follow-up and safety net, and I think they're probably safe.
Okay.
You know, when you're suspecting this is more of a vestibular thing, you might have a bit of a thing, or might want to do an MRI scan. That could probably be done as, and that's the other, well, I suppose this is one thing I'd probably add that I did want to say, is that it took me up until fairly recently to get comfortable with doing, is actually saying to patients I don't know. We do it a lot in TIA now.
I think I'm really good at doing
it. Yeah, like, do you know what? It's quite a release, isn't it? It's like, so you can say, I don't know. It's either this or this.
Mm.
This is what I'm going to do. Yeah. And often I'll say, look, I don't think it's a stroke. I think it's likely to be with your ear. However, this little bit of it's worrying me. Therefore, I'm going to treat you for the stroke because that's the more serious thing. Give them some aspirin and clopidogrel. Whatever they're putting them on, send them on their way, if they're safe to walk out. If I don't have anything urgent I need to do as an inpatient, if they don't need physio, and get the MR done fairly urgently and then see them back in a follow-up clinic.
But that's life. If you're honest with people.
That's it.
And patients love honesty.
Yeah.
They don't like people. I can't swear. It's so difficult to swear sometimes.
Can we not beep it out?
Yeah. Like people beep, beep, beeping them. Yeah, but they don't, and they respond well. So a follow-up to that question, if it's a posterior stroke, I mean, if it's a sort of peripheral, we often use beta-histine and that sort of stuff. Is there any use using that in a central cause, or is it not?
I think probably not.
Yeah.
In my experience of it, I don't think any of them work. Which is
can be, maybe that put that in a little bit of your armory of your diagnostic tool.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, to take these, they don't work.
Then we'll MRI.
And I can distinctly remember one patient. I think we had to actually get palliative care involved, not because the patient was at any way end of life or anything. We just had intractable symptoms, and you know, they did actually quite help. I think we used haloperidol or something. But yes, it can be quite difficult. I think beta histine's only really licensed for many areas, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. Seems to be thrown around quite a lot.
Yeah. It does. And then prochlorperazine. But of course, then these things can contribute to falls in older people, which is where my conflict comes in. So,
but what hat am I wearing? What drug am I going to prescribe? Okay, so any other questions from you, Peter?
No, I think I'm out of questions. I think
that's been answered. Anything else you want to add? No? Lovely. I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much. Another whole podcast of pearls of wisdom.
Yeah.
A posterior stroke. I'll try and forget that MRI doesn't always show it because that just hurts. I think I feel more comfortable approaching the dizzy patient in terms of stroke now.
I think it is, you know, just I think it is really actually, it's difficult. And I think it's difficult for, you know, in neurology trainees who also find it extremely difficult at times as well. And it can be quite non-specific. So we're, what is it, what they said, 35% of them can be missed. So can't all
you're not alone.
You're not alone.
With a cheery note on our clinical ability, we'll say goodbye for today. Thank you.
Thank you all for listening to another episode of the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. We hope this episode has been interesting and helpful for you all. Please do go to the SAM website, www.acutemedicine.org.uk, for all things acute medicine, including show notes from today's episode under the education menu. You will also find more information about acute medicine, the team, and how to contact us individually. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter using @acutemedpod and let us know what you thought, as well as topics you'd like us to explore in future episodes, or if you want to get involved, we'd love you to get involved. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you can join us next time.